Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Standing by, the Terry and Ted podcast is sponsored by the UPS Store Canada. You can print, ship, and more at the UPS Store, theupsstore.ca.
Another episode of the Standing By podcast, season four. Hi, I'm Terry DeMonte, and there is a local stand-up comedian and also morning show host, Ted Bird. Hello, Ted Bird.
How do you do, young man?
I'm doing just fine. We've got a guest on this episode that we're very excited about. And in keeping with tradition, Ted, we're going to be rude, not to very un-Canadian of us. We'll ignore the guest while we thank one of our sponsors of the Standing By podcast. And this is a sponsor that we are absolutely tickled to have aboard because who'd have thunk an engineering firm would have hired a couple of knuckleheads like us to be brand ambassadors for them? What the hell is going on with Sean and the good people at Voswin?
It is a bit of a head scratcher, isn't it? Well, Sean thinks that even if we're knuckleheads, that maybe some of the folks who watch and listen to the podcast can use their services. Voswin is an engineering consulting firm that can help you if you have an existing product or service or something on the drawing board that has an engineering component to it that you need help with. They do mechanical and industrial engineering and design, electrical engineering and design, and software engineering and design. They can help you out in any of those departments. Sean said, to give you an idea of who we are, we looked at buying a CNC machine a year ago. I don't know exactly what a CNC machine is, but it's something to do with innovation and engineering.
Doesn't have anything to do with trains?
No, sir. Not that I'm aware of. And Sean said, when we saw how much it cost, almost $100,000, we said, wait, what do we need this for? And after listing the features we needed, I said, shit, let's just build one. And that's what they did. They built it for less. And that's how they can help you out as well. Like I said, if you have a product or a service or something on the drawing board that has an engineering component that you're not certain about, Voswin can help you out. Voswin.com is where you can find them online. And I think you should, don't you know?
Yeah. And as we like to say about them every time we talk about them, nicer guys you'll never meet. They're just wonderful, wonderful folks.
With big, giant brains.
Yes. All right. Our thanks to the folks at Voswin. Thanks for joining us for this episode. Last season, we attempted to get this gentleman to join us as a guest, and there was some kind of technical issue that embarrassed the hell out of Ted and I, and he's been gracious enough to come back and join us. He's, I don't know where to start, a writer, an author, a columnist, a magazine editor, a Montreal Canadiens fan, a political panelist on the television and radio airwaves. He's a dad. He's a good pal. He's a friend to prime ministers and business leaders. He's an author of a book that described the events surrounding the Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin era of the Liberal Party, and probably one of the nicest people we know. Anthony Wilson Smith is our guest. Anthony, thanks so much for agreeing to come back and join us.
Gentlemen, you see, I'm elevating the tone of your program already. Engineering, this, we're all there. Start with Habs fan. That's a pretty good beginning.
It was really nice of you to come back because I don't remember what happened. We get started. We had you on the Skype machine, and then you were gone, and it was a whole thing. After my wife and I joined you for lunch in Toronto, I think I told you this season of the podcast, I'm unable to travel. So Ted and I are in different places and you're at home in Toronto. And we just are very, very grateful for your time because we're recording this on the weekend. So that's awfully nice of you. We appreciate that.
You guys are always fun to hang with anyway.
I want to start. I forgot to mention that you're the CEO of Historica Canada, which is your current job. But you've had so many different lives over the past 20, 30 years. Can we start with how you ended up becoming a national figure? I mean, you were a kid from NDG. Were you always interested in politics and writing?
Yeah, you know, I actually paid my way through Concordia as the sports editor of the NDG Monitor. And there's still people around NDG who wonder what I've done with my life ever since I left. And can't believe that I did that. But yeah, I always wanted it until I kind of got up one day when I was editor of Maclean's near the end and thought, I've done the things I wanted to do. But, you know, I wanted to write. I wanted to have that kind of have a shot at having a bit of a national voice. I wanted to see the world. And of course, I did 3 years working out of Moscow and saw about 35 or 40 countries, did all the provinces and territories. And, you know, and that was, of course, a different era when you could do that. And a lot of my curiosity was well served. And by the time I got into the dad business, I was, instead of thinking there's a plane, I want to be on it, I was starting to think, you know, maybe I'm good right here. Maybe I don't want to get on planes anymore now that I've got a great life going at home. So that was a big part of change of life.
Can you talk a little bit about your time in Russia? Because this was behind the Iron Curtain, correct?
Yeah, it was the end of, it was right near the end of the Gorbachev era. So, you know, a lot of the really nasty stuff of the 60s, 70s, and 50s before of total Cold War was gone. But it was still a very weird place. You know, you lived in foreigners' compounds. You're expected to socialize really only with other foreigners and not be around much. You shopped at special stores where you used dollars. When I wanted to buy a car, I went out to Helsinki to get it and drive it in from there. And all of those stories about, you know, the KGB's following you, the Komitet Государственной Безопасности, that he was the old full name, that they're following Westerners everywhere. I think not so much, you know, especially with a Canadian by that point in time. Although there were a couple of occasions, particularly getting out of Moscow, that where you were reminded that, you know, you were not operating completely on your own.
Have you been back since, Anthony?
No, it's funny. You know, I'm one of the last sort of fossils of that era because I have not been back to see the change. And the other one was, I was in, when there were still two Berlins, I was in East Berlin about a month before the wall came down. And what I would say then is I remember that if you ever thought there was going to be such a thing as a thousand-year Reich and there was a place that was going to last forever, it was East Berlin then, you know, or East Germany. And that was the one place where I was aware of very definitely being actively followed. And they tried a couple of setups, not the old sex traps, but just trying to get me to trade foreign currency with somebody who looked a little too well-groomed to be in that business, you know. But it was sure a different time.
So the Stasi, who were the East German secret police, were they even nastier than the KGB in your experience?
Oh, the Stasi were nastier than anybody. They were bad actors. And you know, in the years after when the files were opened up really showed that. I never saw a record on me because I never looked. And yeah, I wasn't there that long. I was two visits over the years. But there was a file on pretty much every single living citizen. And it was really remarkable. It was, you know, the old cliche about German efficiency directed all the wrong ways.
Yeah.
When you get posted there, Anthony, what kind of instructions do you get from the people who send you there?
Figure it out when you land. don't call me in the middle of the night if you get arrested.
Wait, yeah. So they don't give you a heads up for, you have to use your own skill and your own common sense. For example, when a spook tries to get you to exchange money or entrap you in some way, you've got to figure it out yourself.
Actually, I'm being a bit unfair there. The magazine, this is with Maclean's, and the magazine was great. They sent me to Russian immersion school at a military academy in Vermont, where I spent 2 months. You know, eventually, I wouldn't say I became fluent, but I got working knowledge, you know, enough to move around on my own. I had briefings from, you know, when I arrived in Moscow at the Canadian embassy on Starokonyushenny, the street they were on, and also in advance of that. And you just listen a lot to your elders. I was pretty young then, and you talk to people who've been around for a while, and they tell you the traps to watch for that seem so innocent. You know, you get a pretty good grounding that way. But, yeah, just keep your head up.
Because you, at that age, you can be, you know, I think of myself back, you know, when I was around that age, pretty naive. I guess I would have been arrested in a big hurry.
Yeah, the other thing, well, you know, there were traps you couldn't do anything about. And one of them was you had foreign plates on your car and we were driving foreign cars. So, you know, there was a bit of an old trick, which was not government planned, but the militia, the police, the traffic police would see you coming and just pull you over. And then they would tap their necks, which was the sign for we think you're drunk. And, you know, never mind if you'd had nothing to drink, they could make life very difficult. So that was one idea, was that you pulled out your stack of American dollars, which is the real going currency, to get your way out of it. In other words, these weren't high-level Kremlin-planned traps. Very often it was somebody trying to figure out how to score and make a buck, you know, at a lower level, but no less dangerous, maybe more so for that.
Go ahead, Ted. Was there an opportunity to get to know people on a personal level, to put the politics aside and actually get to know Russian people one-on-one and learn what they were like?
Yeah, it was a fast change. That wouldn't have been the case 5 years earlier, Ted. We're talking late 80s, early 90s here. But I actually made, some quite good friends. Now, I had a particularly good friend, a guy named Artyom Borovik, who'd been raised, in fact, in the U.S. because his dad was a member of what they called the nomenklatura, the high-end working at the U.N. And Artyom was a curious mix of, you know, raised in U.S., very Americanized English, but very Russian, and a reformer. And, you know, through him, I met a lot of people. He eventually died in, I'm not even sure we would call it an accident anymore. It was a plane crash that just, you know, the circumstances still stink. So,
jeez.
Wow. And if you were to run into somebody today, Anthony, is your Russian still up to scratch?
Yeah, do my Russian again. We'll go get a Russian. Yeah.
I think he's having a stroke, Ter.
I'll take that as a da.
Sure.
And is the vodka as good as I think it is?
Well, here's the thing about vodka, right? It's actually, like a lot of Russian food then, the best you could have was outside of Russia. So while I was there, and again, you know, let's remember, we're looking about 30 years here. The tradition with Russians locally was they had got a different kind of vodka, less ability, but it also came with a disposable cap. You just flipped it off, because the whole thing was, once you start on a bottle of vodka, why would you ever want to recap it?
Yeah. Did you ever get to eat at McDonald's there?
Yeah, I was there when George Colheim, of course, Canadian, came over. And as you recall, it was the Canadian as opposed to U.S. McDonald's. That was the easier way to get it through. And for years, I had a very handsome McDonald's sweatshirt with the logo, but everything written in Cyrillic that they were giving out the first days. But, you know, people quite literally used to fly in from Siberia. And they would take back as many as they could get. They'd get six or eight and they'd stick them in their suitcase and in the microwaves. They would just, you know, it was still a great thing to eat cold a week later.
Were you there at the time? Because that was quite a Canadian story, what George Colheim did there.
It was remarkable work. And, he, of course, the funny thing is that he's originally American, but it really got McDonald's off the ground in Canada. And it was tremendous. And he was a tremendous salesperson. He really just went in and you just knew he wasn't leaving until he closed the deal, and he stayed on them. And he played the fact that Canadians have had traditionally a very good relation, you know, truly based on cliches like hockey, shared cold weather, and indigenous presence in both countries, you know, a lot of things like that.
I worked at the McDonald's at the corner of Atwater and St. Catherine during the 1976 Olympics. And I was there the day George Colheim brought a delegation of Russians who were in for the Olympic Games to see the McDonald's in action at the corner of Atwater and St. Catherine. And we nearly, put an end to the deal because we were so nervous that George was coming to the store, and you know, everything had to be so spick and span. We were cleaning the floors about every 22 minutes. And when the delegation arrived, one of the members of the delegation slipped on that McDonald's tile floor and fell backwards on their ass. And we thought, uh-oh, we've scuttled the deal. George Colheim's going to fire us all. And of course, it all went forward. It's a remarkable story. And if I'm not mistaken, he's turned into quite a philanthropist in Toronto. Isn't that right, Anthony?
Yeah, I had always been very community engaged, very approachable, easy to talk to. At the same time, as that's your story, Terry, is very emblematic. I mean, a real perfectionist, and he was going to make sure. And he was never going to open anything at McDonald's until he was sure that, as he always went on, that, you know, a sandwich, as he called burgers from McDonald's, was going to taste the same in Moscow as it was anywhere else that you could have one, that the consistency would be there.
Before we move off the topic of Russia, because there's lots to talk about, Anthony, and I don't want to delve too deeply into politics, but what's your take on what's happening now?
Well, you know, first of all, when we saw, you know, I spent quite a bit of time in Ukraine as well. Going to Kiev was almost like going home. You fly in and it looked like, you know, the prairies, and it was reminiscent in a lot of ways of Winnipeg. You could see why so many people settled from there into the prairies. But there's always been this Russian attitude of kind of big brother to Ukrainians, of looking down on them. And it was very apparent then. And that's, you know, one of the signs, almost like if someone from London landed in the Appalachians and looked around and said, yeah, well, you may have the same language, but I'm better, you know. So that drove a lot of it. The other was what my friend Artyom, who I just referred to, used to say was, you know, he always said, I used to argue very optimistically about democracy coming in and how great it would be. He said, no, you don't understand. It's not going to take care, because, you know, Russians, we really actually don't care that much about democracy unless it will make us money. We want a strong leader who will make us a world power again, which is why they'd come to resent Gorbachev. So, you know, what we see with Putin is that he became popular by doing that. And the problem now is, of course, he simply has created no, you know, there is no exit out for him. In other words, you know, you can't diplomatically retreat, because that would be like admitting defeat, and he will never do that. He'll, you know, he would give up anything before that. So it's as bad as it has seemed for some time.
Wow. What was the transition, Anthony, from covering different beats for McLean's to becoming editor? How did that happen?
Well, you know, you get to points, everything's kind of cyclical. And after a while, I started, you know, I'd always said, I'm a reporter. That's all I do. I write stories and I like to tell them. And I'd said that for years, and I'd had a couple of offers from other places. So no. And then I finally got to the point of thinking, why is that all I do? You know, why, instead of just filling two or three pages of the magazine, why don't I think about whether I could have, you know, play this active lead role in everything that goes into the magazine? And that was at the, you know, I started thinking that as our editor, an old friend, really, Bob Lewis, who's still very active around things, as Bob was moving on up within the Rogers chain. So, you know, I pursued that thinking, you know, everything, you know, lots to gain, but and nothing to lose, because if that doesn't happen, then I'm having a lot of fun doing what I'm doing. Also, though, I was about to become a dad for the first time, and I thought, you know, not getting on planes, as I said, that's now a very good thing.
And as editor of the magazine, It's all at your fingertips, right? From the cover to the content to the way it looks to the position, that the editorial position that it takes, it's all in your hands, correct?
Yeah, everything is there. I mean, you do it in consultation, of course, with your senior editors. You're talking with your publisher. You're taking a lot of factors into account. But yeah, you're really sort of deciding how, you know, will you turn the volume all the way up to 11 to, you know, to sort of make a big noise? Or, you know, what sort of approach will you take, a subtle, low-key approach to a certain kind of story? The trade-off that's funny is that you lose that, you know, that direct contact that you have with senior people, you know, going out and seeing prime ministers on a regular basis or otherwise. And that was one of the things, you know, I went into that job, which I did for 4 years, and I remember coming home on the day of the appointment and saying to Deirdre, to my wife, you know, so that's the first day of the last job that I will have in journalism. You know, I resolved then I was going to do it for anywhere from 4 to 7 years. And as it was, I was lower end at 4, and, you know, I'm very happy at that, and then moved on.
What was your most controversial cover?
Oh, boy. Not really. That's a good question, and I don't have a good answer, really. You know, in a way, it's funny to, you know, there's a lot of pressure to run what's called soft covers at times, or there's a feeling like, you know, in other words, the social one, you know, why cats are better than dogs kind of thing.
Right.
So there's an old line that came out of somebody with the founder of People magazine, who used to talk about the formula for what sells in the magazine world. And similarly, by the way, online now, which was something to the effect of, movie stars are better than athletes. Athletes are better than television stars. Television stars are better than local figures. You know, drama is better than comedy, and anything better than politics except world events, which are the worst of all. So in other words, anytime you were making a decision to, you know, you thought, here's a really big world story and I want to, you know, I want to give it a big ride, then you're also thinking, I have to accept the fact that cover sales will be, newsstand sales are going to be maybe 25% if I ran, you know, something on the wonderful Rick Mercer or otherwise. So you're kind of dealing with those tensions all the time. And having been, of course, outside as a correspondent for so long, your gut tells you, I want to do the international story, but it doesn't always make sense.
It must have been, those must have been difficult decisions, because there were, you know, like when a big decision affected the country, you know, whether it was Mulroney with the free trade agreement or whatever, you know, you couldn't put like Charo on the cover when that was going on, right?
No, and I always remember, this is before I became editor, but the longtime editor of McLean's who hired me, a guy named Kevin Doyle, I was in Moscow at the time and I came back to Canada for a visit, and it was the weekend of Tiananmen Square, you know, which a lot of people will remember, the killing by the Chinese government of a lot of dissidents in the public square. And that was on a Saturday. And on the Monday, the magazine came out and it was the cover of the start of the Blue Jays season, as I recall. And that was the big cover. And I went in to see him about a day after that when I landed, and he was pacing around his office, just agonized. And he said, that's just like, he was killing himself that he'd gone with the commercially viable cover. But he said, you know, it was a Saturday. I was alone in the office. I was trying to evaluate how serious this was. I knew one, you know, I knew what would do well at the newsstand, but I was trying to figure out how serious this was. And he was just beating himself up. He said, I just, you know, I just can't believe I made that call. And he's probably the only person in the world who sweated it, but he sure did. And that's what made him good.
Oh, do you miss magazines? I miss them.
Yeah, I do. I'm a big online, you know, I'm actually an iPad guy. So I still read stuff and I take a lot of subscriptions, and I'm actually pretty comfortable reading on there. But it's that, it's the long form material that's a lot less of. And I do miss that.
Yeah. Let's take a break before we dovetail into a couple of more topics. Anthony Wilson Smith is our guest, and we've got a number of sponsors, of course, to thank. We can't do this without our sponsors, and I want to take a moment to say thank you to the UPS Store Canada, David Drucker, and the hundreds, literally hundreds of entrepreneurs across the country that run the UPS Store can help you with everything from cookies for grandma who lives in Brandon, Manitoba, to sending important contracts to your office in Calgary, or if you need to send leftover stuff from the move across the country like we did over a year ago now, the UPS folks can handle that. There's a UPS Canada store in almost every location or city around the country, probably within a stone's throw of where you are right now. And they can help you, like I said, with moving, with faxing, with they have that the packing popcorn there to make sure that everything arrives unbroken. They have
don't eat it.
yeah, don't eat it. It's not a good snack. Boxes, packing tape, everything that you could possibly need to either further your business as a small business owner, or if, like I said, you've got some stuff that has to go to family who have moved across the country, the folks at UPS can handle that too. And like I said, they're all independently owned. They're entrepreneurs just like you. And if you need help with your small business, just look for the UPS Store Canada near you. Just go to the UPS Store Canada .com, and you'll find a location not too far from you. I have one about 2 kilometers from my house, and I know you do too, right, Ted?
Oh, I would imagine there's at least one handy on the West Island, probably more than one. I have a question, mister.
Yes, sir.
And it's a bit of a loaded question, but I'm going to ask you anyway, Anthony. How much do you think the internet in general and social media in particular has changed journalism, and has the change been for the better?
I'll tell you the good and I'll tell you the bad. So the good is that there is more quantity than ever before, of course, you know, umpteen times, impossible to measure. Like, when you want to find out something, there's no end to it. The bad, of course, is you need to be able to assess what the quality, what the reality of that material is, and anybody can sound authoritative. And of course, you don't know where anybody's coming from anymore on that. What's been a real challenge for people, and I think has been detrimental, is, so take McLean's as an extreme, which was a weekly. I have an assignment. I start working on it on the Monday. I'm going to be writing on the Thursday or Friday. That story will change 3 or 4 times during the week in tone, and I have a chance to adjust to that and still do call follow-up calls maybe into the Friday, Saturday, and fix it up. So I can allow my own view to evolve with the story. In other words, I'm not just writing to a headline I've been given. The problem now with the demand for immediacy, which I've always said is a kind of a false god over and above everything, is, you know, something comes out, a press release, a declaration, something, and you write a story about it, and immediately you've declared a direction for yourself. And it's very hard. And that story may actually change factually dramatically over the next 24, 48, 72 hours. But you're kind of stuck in this hole unless you want to admit, you know, which is tough personally, and your organization may not like, okay, I started off on a bum steer and I'm going to fix it now and go the other direction. That's a hard call for people to make. The other thing is that you're so busy, you know, kind of updating the story that you're missing a chance to reflect on context. Now, having said all that, the other thing is, of course, being able to watch a story unfolding is, you know, is a luxury from a distance that we didn't have in the pre-internet world. So, you know, throw the balls up in the air and keep juggling on certain things.
Do you think journalists today still attempt to tell the objective, unvarnished truth, or do you think that that a lot of what we read now in legacy media is agenda-driven?
There's always been a sense that, you know, you'll do better in your career if you do where your editor would like you to go. And I've always said to people, if you're really interested in a story, read or watch or see in some way more than one source, anything. But, you know, here in Toronto, we have the luxury, well, as you do in Montreal, the luxury of a bunch of papers. If I really want to know about Quebec politics, for example, I'll read the Gazette, I'll read the Journal, I'll read La Presse, and I'll read Le Devoir. And at the end of those four takes, some of which will be dramatically different, I'll feel like I've got a better sense of where, you know, where things are going. It's a much tougher business because, frankly, there's way fewer people covering everything that's going on. The people who are covering it are very often paid a lot less. The career is not as engaging as it used to be. And your chances for advancement for anybody who's ambitious is, you know, it's just, they're not the same institutions. The one thing I will say I'm very uncomfortable with today, though, is the is the journalists are actually encouraged to take positions, in other words, to express opinions, particularly in tweets.
Yep.
I don't like that at all. And, you know, you'll see it, frankly, I remain a fan of some things that CBC does, but they've had a habit for years of their, you know, their on-air reporters just kind of extemporizing at the beginning or end or something. And that's not, you know, that's not where you should be. You should be going into it saying, let me look at this, let me report, let me at least try to be objective in this, and then let's see where things go.
It's a different world for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things that troubles me, Anthony, on that topic is if you look at some of the, I don't know how to properly put this, but some of the things that are taking place at some of the universities that are supposed to be training these journalists, I look at that and I think, you know, I don't think it's because I'm 64 and, you know, in my day we used to do these things, but I look at some of the positions that some of the universities are taking. And they're cranking out people with particular points of view on social agendas. And that, I think that that's troubling to me because that's not an objective, you know, a reporter that goes to a story with a particular point of view isn't objective. And that betrays a journalistic code of some kind. Don't you agree?
Yeah, it's a real change. And, you know, there's even a school of thought that says, you know, it's impossible to be truly objective because your background and a lot of things are tied up with it. So, you know, just get it out there and admit what you are. I think that, you know, I understand the argument. And I think it's a real mistake. I mean, you know, you have to at least try to be objective. But the problem, and, you know, journalistic schools take this into account, is there's a real feeling now, if you want to get ahead in the business the way it is now, you have to build a personal brand. You know, you have to say something, do something, be something that sets you apart from everybody else. And the obvious way to go in that very often is opinion. So, you know, there's a kind of that sense that if you want to make a mark in that, you know, pick your lane and keep following it.
Well, guys like William L. Shirer and Walter Cronkite were able to be successful without doing that, just by being outstanding journalists. But I think maybe the existence of social media now just inspires people to try to stand out, to be opinionated, to
yeah. I mean, everybody having a platform in theory is a pretty fair thing. It's democratic. It's lots of things. But we follow the ongoing debate over and around Twitter right now. I mean, what constitutes free speech versus what about somebody's right to speak versus truth versus this versus that? They're great debates taking place, and they're very important debates. The problem is that most people couldn't give a rat's about those debates. You know, they're discharged. And there's a lot of data to tell you that people, you know, people in choosing the stories they want. Like, you choose the facts that are convenient to you, you know, and that's, you know, it's the old lies, damn lies, and statistics, right? You're going to go with, you know, those arguments that suit, and you're going to find a way. If you don't like, you know, if you feel there's a legitimacy to the other side, or you have a sneaking feeling about that, then the easiest thing is to denounce whoever's saying it. Say, wow, they're just following an agenda. So that's a mess too.
Anthony, who was the first prime minister you met?
Actually, still in school, I remember I met Pierre Trudeau. He came in. We had a teacher who knew him slightly at Concordia in my final year. And I always remember him walking into a room. We'd gone to Ottawa on a bus. And he said, he didn't even announce himself. We still had our backs turned. And he walked in. And we just suddenly heard that familiar nasal voice saying, "Good morning. What are your hopes? What are your dreams? What do you want to be? Who do you admire? Tell me. I want to know." And it's funny. And then we were all just electrified. And then somebody asked him a question immediately about Bill 101. And you just saw the sort of the mask drop over the face. And the rest of the thing was, you know, was a lot of political responses by rote.
Oh, when was the first time you were in the PMO? Do you remember that?
Oh, that would have been in Mr. Mulroney's era. And I knew Mr. Turner, but that was only after the fact. You know, of the prime ministers, I have a pretty comfortable relationship, still often enough see Mr. Mulroney. The same would be true with Paul Martin, and actually, and Mr. Chrétien as well. I knew Stephen Harper a bit in Ottawa, but as you know, he's a much more private guy.
Really. Yeah.
You know, good enough relation, but just prefers to keep to himself. And I won't go, and I happen to know somebody very well. There's a good friend of mine who knows Justin Trudeau very well, Harry.
I have yet to, the reason I ask, Anthony, is I have yet to find an opportunity to be invited or find myself in the prime minister's office. And as a person who loves politics and has an appreciation for the country and is very proud of being Canadian, I wonder if it has the same kind of effect when you're in the PMO that it would probably have if you were invited, say, to the Oval Office. Does it have that sense of history and sort of grandeur when you're sitting in the prime minister's office?
I've actually been in the Oval Office as well, not in a one-off with the Prime Minister, with the President, but no, the PMO doesn't, but that's a good thing, I'll tell you in my view, and it does have a lot of grandeur. One of the things about the American system we sort of forget or overlook is, right, the American system is both kind of queen or king or governor general and political leader all wrapped up in one, where we, as we, you know, we split off the state duties in the governor general or by extension the king. And then we leave the political part to the prime minister. But, you know, so I do prefer that because it means that you can feel critical of the incumbent in office without being made to feel as though you're, you know, betraying the whole nation or, you know, being disloyal in some way. So, but when you go in the office, and let me say flat out, I still continue to actually like politicians, just about all politicians I meet quite a bit and feel that, you know, they're often done a disservice or do themselves one in denigrating in what they do. You feel a real sense in the air, though, that you are somewhere special. You're aware that there are decisions being made in that office every day that will affect, you know, 37, 38 million people down the road. And you get some of that sense of the responsibility that the person in office has to wear. And it's, you know, in that sense, I'm only sorry more people can't have the experience.
How did you end up in the Oval Office? Who was president?
Oh, it was an early trip. We had actually the president was not in the office at that point, so I'm trying to think who it was. It would have been Bill Clinton. Mm.
An impressive place, no doubt, though.
This again was, you know, pre-2001, and we forget how much the world has changed in terms of overall security. You didn't have to get buzzed in and out. Access to the grounds was pretty easy. I can't recall specifically, but I think really if you had almost any form of ID, certainly journalistic ID, you could get in and move around quite comfortably.
Anthony and I were recently at a book launch for Terry Mosher's latest book on the 1972 Canada-Russia Summit series, and Brian Mulroney spoke at that, and he's still got it, eh, Anthony? He's sharp as a tack. He was so smooth and so well-spoken and so charming. I think all the ladies who were there are still floating 2 feet off the air. I was very impressed. I had once or twice before been in his presence personally, but I was really taken with him that evening.
And the thing is, of course, he didn't, you know, that wasn't even planned.
No.
You know, picked it up and ran with it. And every sentence flows out in fully complete sentences, proper things. He can still drop, you know, He can still drop a kill shot when he wants to, you know, very elegantly. And he does it as well, of course, equally well in both languages, which remains enormously impressive, too. Probably, you know, after Pierre Trudeau in a different way, you know, really the most, you know, impressive orator that, you know, of fairly modern times. And at 83, still bringing it. I was at something else again about 10 days ago in Montreal that he was speaking at, and he just ripped it off again.
Anthony, what led to Double Vision? I'm interested in how you became interested in that whole era of Canadian politics.
Yeah, that for the many millions, Terry, who the full title is An Inside Look at the Liberals in Power. And yeah. I'd always been interested in, you know, I've always said that ultimately government is about however many P's it is. It's sort of policy, process, politics, and personality. And personality drives it to a large extent, how you get along with others, who you are yourself, how you do it. So, you know, that was a time when being bureau chief of McLean's had a real clout. In other words, there were, you know, often enough calls from publishers saying, do you want to do a deal? And my old friend Eddie Greenspan was then the Globe and Mail bureau chief. And if anything, I had even more of that. And we got along well. We were already doing public speaking together. So we sat down and said, what would we like to write about, you know? And, we're kind of interested in this ourselves and, you know, love to know more about how the process works. So let's do it. And finding a publisher at that point was actually pretty easy. And it did well. It's in Canadian terms. You know, we got onto the bestseller charts.
It's a really interesting point in Liberal history that Paul Martin, Jean Chrétien thing that went on, what went on behind the scenes was at best competitive and at worst quite ugly, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I do have something of a point of pride that still continuing to have pretty good, actually quite good relations with both. I still speak to both men, and I'm one of a pretty small circle that does get along because of that. They really do get along like two cats in a sack. And Paul Martin is one of my favorite people really in the world, just so fundamentally decent. You've dealt with him, you know, just always sort of excited by the day, by ideas, about wanting to do good. And Jean Chrétien, in his own way, much more kind of gruff and bluff, but, you know, I mean, has devoted his life to public service. But, you know, Paul Martin, essentially, I mean, you know, Paul Martin wanted the PMO at a point when Jean Chrétien wasn't set to give it up. Their personalities and their backgrounds were dramatically different. And I've always said in some ways, the miracle isn't that they fell apart. The miracle really is that they managed to work successfully for about 7 or 8 years together until the wheels came off.
Yeah, the country was in great shape when Paul Martin was finance minister and Jean Chrétien had his hands on the wheel. We were in pretty good shape back then.
Yeah, and, you know, there wasn't a lot of kind of excess verbiage. Yeah. You know, people who remember Jean Chrétien, he used to get mocked a bit for saying, you know, for the fact he always insisted on bullet point memos, no more than one page in length and before he made a decision. I remember talking to him about that a couple of years ago, and he said, you know, people like to make fun of that, but by the time I came into the office, there was not an important portfolio in government that I had not had. He'd had what was then called Indian Affairs, he'd had finance, he'd had foreign affairs, you do the list. And he said, why do I need somebody providing me 20 pages of background material for each when I already know that? You know, cut to the chase, give me that, and we'll go with it. Very similar, by the way, to how Winston Churchill ran British government during the war. It was always one page, no more.
It's sorry, Terry. It's remarkable to me that two of the things that I'll always most remember about Jean Chrétien, the Shawinigan handshake when he when he choked Buddy in the baby hat there, and his a proof is a proof, and when you have a proof that it's proven. Those two things actually added to his legacy in a positive way. Like, everyone remembers both of those things fondly. That's how likable a guy I think he is.
Well, he had no pretense. And I remember going on one of the Team Canada trips, you know, where we were going to Pakistan and India and a bunch of other places. And we were delayed by about 20 minutes because there'd been getting his vehicle out to the airport in the snow. But it also turned out that as he'd left early, he wanted to have a beer. So he just directed the driver to have him stop by a tavern in the Byward Market. And he went in and had a beer with people and he left. And there were no photographers, by the way, around. That's what was notable. And I'll tell you another quick story about him. One of the things I liked most, probably my favorite story ever, was covering the 50th anniversary of D-Day. And I went over a bit in advance with a veteran and we toured and we did a lot. But on the day of D-Day itself, being the fool that I occasionally am, I managed to miss the media bus back from the cemetery where all Canada's dead were buried, and found myself as the only reporter not even really noticed while Jean Chrétien was still there, and so were the veterans. And he spent about 45 minutes with no cameras around, talking to any veteran who wanted to be seen with them when they went up, when people took cameras and wanted to take their picture and said what an honor it was. He always said the same thing: no, sir, no, ma'am, this is my honor, this is your day. And he was not looking for any credit. He just cared.
Tara, I want to go down that road. Let's do another commercial very quickly before we do. Yes. I want to express my deep resentment at Terry DeMonte for not coming into town to do the podcast, because I couldn't call Jaguar Land Rover Laval and say, hey, DeMonte's in town, I'll need one of your vehicles to ferry him around. We've had the Land Rover Defender, we've had the Jaguar F-Type, we've had the Land Rover Discovery Sport, and we've had the Jaguar F-Pace, which is Jag's SUV. Every time Terry comes to town, I go up there and I get one of their vehicles. Couldn't do it this time. So I'm stuck with the Bavarian money pit. And fortunately, knock on wood, it's gotten me to and from the studio so far this season. You should go to Jaguar Land Rover Laval. Even if you're not looking for a car, go up there and maybe pop in next door to McLaren Montreal as well and have a look at those supercars. They will welcome you with open arms, whether you're looking for a vehicle or whether you're in the market or not. They're good people. Nino and Renato De Cubellis, salt of the earth people. They're the owners of Jaguar Land Rover Laval, and their attitude is sprinkled throughout that dealership. Everyone is treated with respect. Everyone is treated like family. And the product speaks for itself, and that's why we always talk about the service you get there. We don't have to tell you about the product. They're Jaguars and Land Rovers, for crying out loud. They're some of the most beautiful vehicles on the planet. JaguarLaval.com and LandRoverLaval.com. Tell them that Terry and Ted from the podcast sent you, and that Ted wants to know if he can maybe take one of the new Range Rovers for a spin.
When you get there, tell them Ted is full of resentment.
But not against them, against DeMonte. Oh,
yeah, that's right. Anthony, to get back just to the Prime Minister thing one more time, one of the things that I think is lost these days is, decency and behavior have gone out the window when it comes to discussing politics and politicians. And, I find myself in places where you start to talk about people like Paul Martin. Here's a guy, is one of the nicest people you'd ever want to meet, always cheery, always kind to everybody that he meets, everybody who's around him. I last ran into him at an event that you invited us to. He just couldn't have been nicer to me and my wife. And when you look at his history, that's a man of means who really didn't have to go into politics, but chose public service because he thought it was honorable and thought it was the right thing to do and thought he could make a contribution, and he did. And there's an awful lot of respect that I have for that man because of that. And that seems to have gone out the window these days. When you talk about politicians, people don't want to hear about that.
You know, well, first of all, absolute, plus one times umpteen for, love and respect for Paul Martin, but a thoroughly decent guy. And, I remember meeting him early when he was finance minister. I knew him a little bit then. He gave me a very detailed breakdown of what a financial statement was going to be like. And then the lead I used for the story, because Paul is a bit of a techno geek, as am I, and this, this will take people of a certain age, but I remember going into his office, and the VCR in his office, the light with the time on it was flashing all the time, which was, of course, the old sign that somebody had absolutely no idea how to run it. And that was the lead I used, just for a self-declared techno geek something. He could have been awfully mad, and he could have said, why did I give this guy a lot of time? He took the hit, and the rest of the piece was very much on the issues he wanted to talk about, but he had that sense of humanity. I think, I agree with everything you say about the lack of respect for politicians. The one area of criticism I have for them is, to some degree, they've invited it. For example, Preston Manning, who can be a smart, thoughtful, decent guy in a lot of ways, used to tell those sort of stories like, what's the difference between a lawyer and a rat? And of course, the punchline was favorable to the rat, or to a politician and a rat, and the punchline was favorable to the rat and not the politician. And something Jean Chrétien did very well was he talked about taking pride in it. He had two big themes. One was talking about the dignity of work for people and really reminding people what an honorable thing it is to do whatever you do for 8 hours a day, as long as you put yourself into it. And the other was to say, I feel good about this, you know. And people would say you're too old for the job when he came in. He said politics is the only business in which people say you have too much experience, which is nonsense, of course, you know. So he really went after that, and I think it's not a coincidence how fondly he's remembered. I mean, even, you know, if you poke Stephen Harper far in a private conversation, he'll tell you the great respect he has for him as well, despite the fact they were politically on the opposite sides.
Is politics attracting the right people, Anthony, and has that changed over the years, do you think?
There are a lot of good people in there right now. I think that the level of scrutiny is beyond sort of what's capable. You know, you have what's happened now, though, is that you used to routinely, for example, have people who had had really successful careers, and then they'd kind of get into their late 40s or 50s and say, okay, now I've done that. I want to try public service. And these were people making many times a politician's, you know, salary because of their level in their field. You don't get those anymore because you're now subjected to this level of scrutiny where you're likely to just say, you know, if you're having a good career, you're like, say, what do I need that for? Like, I'm going to leave my wife, my husband, my kids, you know, my personal life behind so I can go somewhere. So people I've never met will just take pot shots at me. You know? So I think there's a great feeling of, yeah, you know, just not for me.
Well, there's also an opportunity for people. When people look at a public servant salary, a politician's salary now, you know, you go to the other end of the economic spectrum and people might be looking at that and going, holy shit, I can make that much money if I get into parliament. I'm going to run.
Yeah, and that's a problem. You know, I mean, you want, it's just, look, it sounds snobby. To some degree, you want at least some of the people coming to be people who are taking a pay cut saying, I want to do this for the
nobility. Well, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure, absolutely, that's true.
Yeah, and there's also, you know, the today, I mean, the way people, my wife and I talk about this all the time. You see videos of people, whether they're prime ministers or they're ministers with a portfolio, people holding up their phones and screaming the most vile things at people and, you know, yelling and screaming and, you know, whether it's tossing pebbles or, you know, tossing, you know, horrible language their way, you just wonder, you think to yourself, oh my God, why would anybody want to put up with this? You have to have a thick skin and you have to be very, very dedicated to public service these days.
Well, you know, in the other field, frankly, where that happens now is journalism too. I mean, I left journalism. Yeah. Point where it was still an awful lot of fun to do. You're aware of a sense of responsibility, but you could also just really enjoy yourself. And that a lot of that joy is gone because it's the same issues. You know, a lot of that dislike or just plain hate is being directed back at people, not because of who they are, but because of the stories they report and the perceived tone, whether that's what they really intend or not, taken with it.
Anthony, let's talk about your current gig. When I was a kid, I remember watching TV in the afternoon and, you know, my first exposure to campaigns that tried to make us aware of the country was, first of all, there was Hinterland's Who's Who,
yeah.
You know, the do, do, do,
do, do, the humpback whale,
the loon is found. And then I remember seeing these sort of one act plays over the course of 60 seconds about what happened in our history. And I remember thinking, wow, these things are really fascinating. And it's cool that we're starting to recognize that Canada does indeed have a history. And now it's quite the huge deal. And you're the CEO of the place called Historica Canada. Can you speak about how it started and how you ended up in charge?
We speak, of course, of the Heritage Minutes. Absolutely.
Yes.
Oh, in fact, Montreal roots too. And, you know, the direct creation of the much beloved, still very active with us, native Montrealer, Charles Bronfman. So Charles in the late 80s, you know, in the wake of the first Quebec referendum and a lot of other issues, became concerned that people were losing a sense of what Canada was or had never had it, arguably. You know, we were just kind of, well, we're not American, we're not French, we're not British. So I guess we're, you know, this mix in the middle. And he still used a quote that still resonates now. He said, you know, every country has its myths and legends on which, you know, the story of the country is built. In Canada, we had those, but we weren't telling those stories. So he resolved to do it, and they went looking around, and they formed a small group to talk about it. And either, he doesn't remember, Charles said either he or one of the other people around the table said, you know, if you can sell soap, detergent, or, you know, a kind of food in 60 seconds, why can't you sell a country? And really, out of that, it was born. So the early ones were, you know, I forget the precise order, but Jacques Plante and the goalie mask, you know, as the first goalie to wear it regularly, just to kind of get mainstream interest in it. The remarkable story, which is still one of my favorites, of the three fellows from the same street in Winnipeg, all of whom won the Victoria Cross in the First World War. Jeez. So that, you know, since that street since renamed Valor Road, and on from there. And we've now made more than 100, of which I've been directly involved in about 25.
Are there any particular ones, Anthony, that have resonated with audiences more than others that stand out to you?
Yeah, I mean, in broad, vast broad terms, Ted, sure. Well, I think the first one that would come to mind of ones on my watch would be in 2019. Go back to D-Day again. We did to commemorate the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and we did one on a fellow in World War II who went back to war, went off to war when he was 39, living on a farm in New Brunswick, by the way, Ted. You know, re-enlisted despite the fact he was a father, had kids, certainly didn't need to do this. In fact, in some ways was discouraged. And he stayed, you know, and he stayed through training and everything with his men and said, we need him. They kept saying, you should go home now. You don't need to go into combat again. And he refused because he said, my men need me. And he wrote letters home to that effect. And on D-Day, he led his men into battle, led them through a couple of towns, was killed in action by then 46 or 47. And last I checked, which was about a year ago, his daughter, you know, who lost her dad there for 6 or 7 years of age and had her life changed as a result, was still living around Montreal. Wow. And it was an example to me of how events that seem so far off so long ago, before any of us are born, continue, you know, whole towns are changed because of what happened then, all the boys, all the men, and you know, and some women who never came home, all the people who lost fathers, husbands, who grew up differently as a result. Towns, particularly that was North Shore Regiment, Ted, of your native New Brunswick. So all those small towns that never grew up the way they should have because the leaders of the next generation were lost. And that effect is still lost today. And that's now, that was seen in the first month alone of release by about 7 or 8 million people. And I, you know, I hadn't seen latest figures, but we'd certainly be in the multiples of that now.
That's amazing.
That, I didn't know that story about Valor Road. When I lived in Winnipeg, I lived blocks from Valor Road. I didn't know that, Anthony.
I lived there some years ago, and the first thing I did was actually before I went to my hotel, I said to the driver, take me there just so I could see the sign and kind of feel it.
Yeah. So what's the criteria now? Who decides? I mean, you're the CEO, so I guess you have the final stamp of approval, but how do you decide? Because as you dive into history, there's a lot to talk about.
Well, of course, everyone that's enormously popular is completely my decision. And of course, those that don't, well, I can't imagine how that happened. They were out of day when I was away. No, it does stop there, but they're a funny mix. So for anybody, before anybody sends ideas, which are always welcome, the first criteria for being in one is that you need to no longer be alive. We don't do them about living people because they're too familiar in general, you know, and using an actor kind of takes away from the authenticity and some other reasons too. It has to be an event that changed the course of, you know, helped shape Canada the way it is today. Sometimes not to good effect, sometimes, of course, to very good effect, and has a significant thing. And in recent years, frankly, we've focused as well on groups that have not had the same degree of attention, you know, in history. And that means specifically, of course, Indigenous peoples. So we did one earlier this year on the great Indigenous marathoner and war hero, Tom Longboat, from the First World War, who, you know, faced a lot of discrimination along with his accomplishments or despite his accomplishments. We have one out just out right now, in fact, off to a good start on the great transgendered singer Jackie Shane, who scored chart-topping hits in Toronto in the 1960s at a time when being Black was a challenge, being transgender was unheard of, and really moved the dial along.
Do you get blowback when you go down that? Sorry, Anthony, do you get blowback when you go down that road, or have we progressed to the point where people are, okay, let's talk about this?
It's interesting, Dan. You know, there's been a couple of notes in about that. Not to the degree, I remember we went through this about 4 years ago when we released one on the LGBTQ community and the so-called Egan case, of which went to Supreme Court over giving full, you know, equivalent of marital rights to gay or lesbian couples. And I remember stealing our staff, who are mostly young, and saying, watch out for the blowback on this. And it never came. There's a segment of the population that doesn't want to hear, and or gets really upset. There's some who are intensely supportive, of course. And then there's a whole lot of Canadians in the middle who are kind of saying, it seems to me, let me hear the story. Let me hear how this is. I just want to know. And that's kind of what we're seeing so far. Our feeling in doing that, by the way, and excuse me for a longer answer, but, history is always under attack in forms of things or how history is taught. And I tend to say that for Canada or really for anything, there's four central points to how we approach history. One is that this has been an absolutely fantastic country to live in for virtually a vast majority of people who either came here or were born here. But with the notable exception, point two of, demonstrable bad treatment of Indigenous people and also, through laws and otherwise of people of color, very often people who came here at certain points. The third point would be that by any measure quantifiably that you look at, there's much less discrimination in Canada today than there was at any point in our previous past, 10 years, 20 years, 100 years ago. But the other point to that is you can still look and say there's examples here where it has to get better. And the way in which you tell history, to me, if you miss any of those points, you're not giving a full picture. But you need to also tilt toward the fact of reminding people, this remains a place where, people are enormously proud and with good reason.
You find that most Canadians are somewhere in the center.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, Canadians don't mind hearing about, Canadians are prepared to hear about things that we need to do better. But they also, it's a principle in the magazine business or anything else too. You need to remind people that things have gotten better, that there's always ways to improve. Like, in other words, if all you just say is life sucks and everything's bad.
Yeah.
Nothing's going to happen, right? Then life really will suck and everything really will get worse. And, I'm not an incurable optimist about things, but I will say, having done 35 or 40 countries, and travel, there's certainly nowhere I'd rather live.
Speaking of that, that's a good segue into what I wanted to ask you next about, Anthony, and that's the Montreal thing that gets in your blood. I'm talking to you from the Fraser Valley in British Columbia. I love this country. I've lived in Alberta. I've lived in Manitoba. I was born and raised in Quebec. I was a proud Montrealer, and now I'm in British Columbia, and it's like I can't drink enough of the country in. But no matter where I go, and no matter where I've lived, and I know you think this too, because you often make reference to NDG, scoot down 401 to Montreal, and yet you haven't lived there for years. And my wife and I talk about this, the amount of time we spend talking about Montreal in our home in the Fraser Valley in British Columbia, and the amount of time we spend looking for a hot dog and trying to find a good bagel is absolutely absurd. What is it about Montreal that gets in the blood that makes you and me and thousands of other expats long for that city?
Well, and I'll say the first part does lead into a second part. I've been in Toronto for years now, and I love it. It's got a lot of charms. Like, I'm really, really fond. But I'll tell you a story. When I met Deirdre a million years ago, we got along immediately. It was, just felt, I think, immediately like, this is great. We're going to continue this. So we had a discussion one day early, and I said to her, in as much as, this matters, we are the same religion, and, for whatever it counts, but I do need to, you want you to agree to one thing, and Deirdre's a native Torontonian, and that's that any children that we have will be raised as Habs fans. And she agreed immediately, and our daughter, who's now in law school at 24, would not really identify as a sports fan, but if you push her, she'll say, I'm a Habs fan. And when PK signed his long-term deal years ago, she was the one who contacted me with an urgent instant message saying, PK just signed. And my son, our son who's 21, was a very, very good hockey player, was born in Toronto, then lived in Ottawa, then came back to Toronto and remains a resolute Habs fan. So yeah, it's in your DNA, but there's a charm, there remains a charm to the actual on the street, the fact of a multitude of languages, particularly, of course, French paramount among, like, on the street, it continues to work if we leave, get away from language laws and things. there is a really specific feel. And, you know, I lived 3 years in Quebec City as well. And I always said that when I went there early in my career, yeah, my French wasn't as good as it is now, but, you know, I could get around. I never faced discrimination in Quebec City as an Anglo. Where I got hammered all the time was that was when the Nordiques were still there. And for being a Habs fan, and they just beat up on me. So, and in the course of my career as a reporter, I've done everywhere, I think, literally from Chibougamau to Chicoutimi to Matan to, Amqui and the Matapédia Valley and a bunch of places beyond. And there's really nowhere like that for such a combination of things, it really just gets in your skin.
A lot of people have said to me, oh, Ter, it's just because it resonates with you because it was your childhood. Because I do what you do. I know when you go back to Montreal, you like to drive through the streets of NDG and see the rinks and all of that. But there's more to it than that. It's not just about your childhood. I don't know what it is. I suspect Winnipeggers feel that way when they go back to Winnipeg, but there's just something odd about an ex-Montrealer that, as my wife would say, she's experienced here. Somebody said to her, you ex-Montrealers are a pain in the ass. You're always talking about the city.
Well, I remember, our friend Aislinn, Terry Mosher, years ago doing a memorable cartoon, and he was making fun of, I think, reactions to multiculturalism or something, Terry being in favor. But he did one of just two people looking at each other and saying, it used to be so much easier when it was just us, them, and the Irish. It was kind of this breakdown. And then we watched and saw the city change so much, and I watched and lived through it. And it became, I think, more dynamic, more exciting. And, having grown up, and certainly NDG is where my roots, always return. I do that drive along Cavendish, Summerlid, and past the old arena where I played very badly and then coached for a long time. And you saw us at, there's not a rink in Ontario I don't think I've been into, but there's still a special magic to those.
Yeah. My wife said to me last night that we were watching the Habs game. Of course, out in BC, you watch the Habs game at 4:30.
Yeah.
And we were watching the Habs game, and she said to me, you want to order a pizza from B&M? And I said, well, yeah, we could order a pizza from B&M and NDG, but it's going to take a while to get here. it just never seems to end. It's just something I thought I'd ask you about, because we touched upon it briefly when you and I and Jess had lunch in Toronto. And you seem very at home in Toronto. And I too love Toronto, and you've been there for a very long time. But you like me, you like to drink from the fountain that is Montreal every once in a while.
Yeah, I wonder,
multicultural place too. But I think of, I'll give you an example from Historica. We have four staff members in Montreal now. And one of them, was about 24, 25, born in Hong Kong, came here at an early age with his parents. Speaks Mandarin and Cantonese, speaks perfect English and French, and he's a Germanophile, so he's picked up German as well. Jeez. You're not finding that in a lot of other cities around, like that degree of, and it's that sort of, ben, on commence en français, puis on va ajouter un autre mot in another language, and then yes, sir, at the end or something. It's like it's all mixed up in there.
Yeah. Here's the last question I want to ask you, because I talked about this with Jess. Who gets to call you Tony? Because I know some people call you Tony. I've never called you Tony. Does everybody call you Anthony?
It's not a funny, amusing story. When I was a kid in NDG, it was either Anthony or inevitably when you play hockey, they just cheat with your last name. So I became Smitty, right? Yeah. When I was moving to Quebec City, I resolved to myself, I just said, I can be called many things in life. I will not be called Antoine. I just will not. It's not a bad name. I just can't let that happen to me. So in journalism, I picked it up and became Tony. So people have worked with me professionally for years will say that. People from NDG will say Anthony. People from journalism particularly will say, of course, you may know my other two nicknames are just Tony Two Names for the Wilson Smith or Tony hyphen within. And I fall back to the, call me what you want. Just don't call me late for dinner, old nine. I'm never bothers me any of those.
Yeah, I can't. It was one night we were watching. You were on a panel, as you often are, and somebody said, "Thanks, Tony." And we said, "Who gets to?" I don't know who gets to call him Tony. I don't know what the history is. So
whoever wants the Anthony, or whoever wants something, nothing offensive. We're good with it.
Anthony, I can't thank you enough. This has been a lot of fun. We covered a lot of topics, and I really enjoyed having you. And I can't thank you enough for the time. Again, you know, we've wanted to have you on the podcast since the first season, and we came awfully close last season until we had a technical issue. So you've been very patient with us. I can't thank you enough for us.
Seriously love hanging with both of you guys separately or together. I'm going to do one excuse to your other sponsors, but I have to do a final shout out to my friend Louie, who is the courier driver from Guess What Company.
I don't want to say the wrong company.
Oh, it's the right company. It's the right company. It is
UPS store. It is
Louis, the UPS driver, who never comes to my house without a package of dog biscuits for Ted, our 13-year-old German Shepherd Border Collie rescue dog, and is just the most efficient guy in the world. And they're a friendly bunch.
Wow, isn't that nice? Please tell Louis we said thank you. I'll pass it along.
And if I can, I'll be prepared to say very nice things if I get use of a Jag in future sometime too.
Okay. Anthony, thanks so much. And we'll talk soon. Yeah. Look forward to our next breaking bread together.
A bientôt.
Okay. Salut.
Salut, Antoine.
That was fun having Anthony Wilson Smith on. I have to tell you, when I first met him, I was very, very intimidated. Because he's erudite, and he's such a bright guy. And then you learn that he's a very decent, kind, wonderful, warm man.
He's disarming is what he is.
Yeah.
He makes you feel at ease as soon as you meet him.
Yeah. And what a history he's had.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, what did he say? 40 countries?
Yeah. 40 countries. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to have, lunch and dinner with him. And he tells some great stories about, you know, guys in the CIA and, you know, some of the, you know, the Russian guys following him around. And, you know, who knew there was a military camp in Vermont? I didn't know that.
Not a clue, sir.
Yeah, not even close.
Maybe we shouldn't talk about that.
Ixnay on the MK, yep. Ted. What I also like too is we managed to steer clear of heavy politics, but I found him, he's such an interesting man.
Well, really, listen, I think we could have gone deeper into heavy politics because he can discuss them objectively. He's not, he's not strident, and he's intelligent, and he's well informed, and his, any opinion he would have would be a knowledgeable one.
Okay. Before we wrap up our edition of this podcast, am I speaking English? I'm not sure if I'm still speaking English.
I understand you, and it's the only language I speak with any kind of thing. I used to, anyway.
Speaking of erudite,
now I'm just illiterate.
I want to say thank you to our friends at Metal Bonheur. I was wondering, because we were giving out the promo codes, and I was wondering if anybody was going to go into a Matelas Bonheur store and give our promo codes, which is the Terry code and the Ted code. One was TER04, and the other one was TED05, and apparently people went in, and I hope, you know, they didn't just walk into the store and go, TER04. I hope they made it clear that they listened to the podcast and were looking for their discount with that. You don't even need that. If you're looking for a new mattress and a better night's sleep, I suggest that you go into a Matelas Bonheur store. I know there are other places to buy mattresses. I say this all the time. But we just have a special relationship with these people. And when you go into the store, you'll see what I'm talking about. It's a family-run business who pride themselves in service, pride themselves in the knowledge that they have about sleep science and all of the latest technologies that there are for sleeping. And yes, there is a sleep technology. They can do anything from make sure you have a mattress for the guest bedroom to making sure they change the way you sleep. If you've been sleeping on a mattress that's 10 years old, you've been sleeping on that thing for too long, go in and have a discussion with them. They'll ask you a couple of questions. It's a great shopping experience. It's a great atmosphere. to buy a mattress in. They'll ask you a couple of questions, give you some information, and then leave you be. They won't follow you around and pressure you. It really is a wonderful shopping experience. And they're all over the greater Montreal area, stores everywhere. My friends at Matelas Bonheur. You can also find them online, of course.
They're the Mersons of the mattress world, Ter.
You are correct, sir.
How's that for a segue?
You know, it's getting more and more impressive. I've known you for a long time, Ted, and you just get more impressive every day.
5 minutes ago, I couldn't put a sentence together. But I want to talk a little bit about the Mersons because they, like Matelas Bonheur, are a local company run by local people. And tell the story about how Mark Merson came up with the owner at the counter as a selling point and a kind of a tagline.
What?
You well, told no, me you that story, what? But when you first started, when you first started doing advertisements for Mark.
Yeah. We had a conversation about, you know, how the fact that when you go into a business, if you have an issue, if you take your car, for example, to a big box store, you know, or one of the national chains or something, and you have an issue, you get turned over to an office in Toronto. The people say, well, you have to contact Al, who's our person in Toronto, or send an email to wedontgiveashit.com. And you don't get to have anything resolved. And we're not saying you're ever going to have an issue with the Mersons. But if you've got a question about what they're doing or why they're doing it, or, you know, you take it in for something and you come back and the buzzing sound is still there, whatever it is, the owner is at the counter. That's what happens when you deal with a family-run business. The owner is there for you to deal with directly, and you don't have to send an email to whogivesashit.com.
And they'll deal with you honestly and with integrity, and that's why they've been in business for three generations. They specialize in tires, and it's winter tire season. Ask Mersons about the Yokohama IceGuard winter tires and the Nokian Hakkapeliitta line, including the Hakkapeliitta 10 and the R5. Those are the two brands that they specialize in. And anything else you need done to your car in terms of repair and maintenance, Merson can handle it. And if they can't handle it, they'll send you to somebody who can, and they'll send you to somebody who, like them, operates with honesty and integrity. They're on St. Jacques, just west of Cavendish, and they're online at mersonauto.com.
By the way, did I tell the right story?
Yeah, well, basically, no. We'll tell it another time.
When you said that to me, I'm like, oh, shit, Ted wants me to tell a story that I don't remember.
Yeah, what's he talking about?
What story is that?
I was just trying to segue, man.
Yeah, well, you did a nice job. Well, that's it. So far for this season, I think it's gone relatively well, considering that we're not sitting across from each other, gazing into each other's eyes, Ted.
Yeah, but Poseidon's had his hand on my leg for the whole show, so okay, you're not missed.
damn. That's the end of the episode. Thanks for joining us. My thanks to my wife Jessica, because she helped me set up all of this. I'm in her. I don't know if you can see behind me.
Yeah.
If you're watching this on YouTube, I'm in Jess's music room. And
does she play those guitars?
Yes, she plays those guitars. Wow. And she plays the drums. And you can't see it behind me. There's, I don't know if you can see it. There's a keyboard and a record collection and. This is for now the studio in the Fraser Valley. Where will we continue?
Yes, we will.
Season four, if I can put my tongue back in the right place. Thanks for joining us. My thanks to Poseidon. My thanks to you, Ted Bird. See you later.
You can print, ship, and more at the UPS Store. theupsstore.ca.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.